Good morning. Good to see you all. Glad you're with us today. My message this morning is entitled Nonviolent Resistance. So, humans have tended to be a race of dominance, a race of power over, a race of violence. As far as I can see, to some degree, we actually always have been. It's so much a part of us that even our linguistic idioms are commonplace to communicate our vindictiveness. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, quid pro quo, tit for tat, let the punishment fit the crime. Retributive justice seems to be an almost primal need for us. When the first ever world report on violence and health was released, it said that death and disability caused by violence make violence one of the leading public health issues of our time. Violence is among the leading causes of death for people aged 15 to 44, accounting for 14% of deaths among males and 7% among females. And on an average day, over 1,400 people are killed in acts of homicide. Almost one person every minute. Roughly one person commits suicide every 40 seconds. About 35 people are killed every hour in direct result of armed conflict.
Worldwide.
Yeah, this is a worldwide report. In the 20th century, an estimated 191 million people lost their lives directly or indirectly as a result of conflict. Now, even religions are violent. Muslim extremists conceptualized and executed September 11. The Spanish Inquisition, well, Christians abused, tortured, and executed more than 300,000 people, including other Christians. 2,000 of those were burned at the stake. Then there's violence based on ethnicity. In the Holocaust or the Shoah, Hitler and the Third Reich killed 9 to 18 million people. In Darfur, an internalized genocide has killed more than 500,000 people in graphically gory ways. And war, of course, kills. In the 20th century alone, over 35 billion people, 35 billion people lost their lives as a direct result of war. Our human lust for power, and as a result, violence, is so strong that we've actually had to create new words to categorize the violence of the powerful. Democide, a new word, is death by government. From government-endorsed famine to regime-initiated massacres, democide outpaced war in deaths in the 20th century, bringing its toll to 119 billion people. One of my favorite authors and theologians, his name's Walter Wink, says that violence is the ethos of our time. It is the spirituality of the modern world. It has been accorded the status of religion, demanding from its devotees an absolute obedience to death. We humans, like it or not, have a tendency to be a violent people. Wink would suggest that whether we want to admit it or not, we don't just like it. In our own way, we worship it. It's not surprising, then, that religion has historically had segments of its varying bodies that have produced antithetical responses to power, war, and violence. Most typically, these segments produce some varying form of pacifisms. Now, Christian, among others, Christians have been at the forefront of the movement, pointing to texts such as turn the other cheek. They oppose war and violence as a means to settle disputes. But in its extreme, pacifism can lead to dangerous, even life-risking perspectives. In its extreme form, pacifists have used religious texts like turn the other cheek to actually encourage people to stay in abusive relationships. And I'll be talking a little bit more about the different perspective on some of those kinds of texts at the 11:15 gathering. There are, however, alternatives to pacifism, or some would say different kinds of pacifism. And many of them don't ask you to get stepped all over. If anything, some of them are the opposite of that and require active, nonviolent resistance. Protesting like we are seeing done by some of the NFL players is a form of such resistance. Now, I've heard it said that many times that while nonviolence is a nice idea, it's ultimately, ineffective. That perspective actually could not be further from the truth. If anything, I believe that the reason others try to shut down folks practicing nonviolent resistance is precisely because they realize that it is working. And as I said as I started, in many ways, humanity is sometimes a race of dominance. Those who wish to maintain their dominance will go to great lengths to see effective resistance, effective work towards equality, effective work towards peace shut down before it has a chance to take hold. We've seen this in the reaction to the nonviolent resistance movements like Occupy Wall Street and Arab Spring, where the powers that be use force and morally repugnant practices to try to shut it all down. But, even before those movements, there have been many, many other effective nonviolent protests. The truth is that from 1900 until now, major nonviolent resistance campaigns that sought to overthrow dictatorships, throw out foreign occupations, achieve self-determination, they were more than twice as successful as violent insurgencies seeking the same goal. So let me say that again. From 1900 until now, major nonviolent resistance campaigns were more than twice as successful as violent insurgencies seeking the same goals. The recent past alone suggests as much. In addition to Arab Spring, nonviolent campaigns in Serbia in 2000, Madagascar 2002, Ukraine in 2004, Lebanon 2005, Nepal 2006, we could keep going. They all succeeded in ousting powerful regimes. In their book entitled Why Civil Resistance Works, the Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict by Erica Chenoweth and Maria J. Stefan, where they use graphs and charts, sociological research, and statistical analysis to show how, in the last century, nonviolent movements were far better at mobilizing supporters, resisting regime crackdowns, creating new initiatives, defeating repressive regimes, and establishing lasting democracies. Now, their evidence points to the conclusion that nonviolent resistance is more effective than armed resistance in overturning oppressive and repressive regimes and in leading to more democratic societies. Frankly, their report should cause the whole world to stop in its tracks and take up nonviolent conflict resolution and nonviolent resistance to injustices. Why Civil Resistance Works. That book is the first systematic study, in my opinion, of its kind to demonstrate once and for all the power of nonviolent civil resistance for positive social change. Honestly, if you are interested in the methodology of nonviolent conflict resolution, I would recommend very highly you getting that book. For that matter, it probably wouldn't hurt the folks in the State Department and government to learn its lessons, renounce violence, start supporting nonviolence, people power movements. I realize that that's a pipe dream, but a boy can dream. One of the reasons that nonviolent campaigns typically appeal to a much broader and diverse group of people than violent campaigns is that what is required of an individual to participate is actually a much lower personal investment. Potential participants in the resistance may need to overcome some fear, but they won't have to overcome any personal, moral, or spiritual issues about using violence against others. You see, civil nonviolent resistance offers plenty of low-risk tactics and ways to be involved, such as stayaways, which are where people vacate typically large populations, boycotts, go slows, where people move at half pace at work to try to make things a little more difficult. All of these types of involvement encourage people to participate without having to make enormous personal sacrifices. As I said earlier, when people hear the word nonviolent, they often think of peaceful or passive resistance. For some, the word brings to mind Pacific groups, getting my Pacific and my pacifist mixed up, brings to mind groups like the Buddhist monks in Burma who may prefer death to using violence to defend themselves against injustice. And as such, they conflate nonviolent resistance and civil resistance with the doctrine of nonviolence or pacifism, which is a philosophical perspective which just rejects violence on moral grounds. But in a civil resistance campaign like those that I have mentioned, very few participants actually are pacifists. Rather, they're ordinary citizens confronting intolerable circumstances by refusing to obey. And the beauty of it is that it's a method available to anyone, pacifist or otherwise. Even Mahatma Gandhi, the iconic pacifist and highly strategic thinker, recognized that nonviolence would work not because it seized a moral higher ground, but because massive non-cooperation would ultimately make the British quit India. He said, "We should meet abuse by forbearance." He said, "Human nature is so constituted that if we take absolutely no notice of anger and abuse, the person indulging it will soon grow weary of it and stop." Well, to begin concluding, in the book, Why Civil Resistance Works, through statistical analysis, Chenoweth and Stefan found that nonviolent resistance presents fewer obstacles to moral and physical involvement and commitment, and that higher levels of participation contributed to enhanced resilience, greater opportunities for tactical innovation and civil disruption, and therefore less incentive for a regime to maintain the status quo. And shifts in loyalty among opponent supporters included members of the military establishment. Contrary to popular belief, they say, violent insurgency is rarely justifiable on strategic ground. Let me say that again. Their research shows that contrary to popular belief, violent insurgency is rarely justifiable on strategic grounds. Not only that, their research strongly suggests that nonviolent resistance ushers in more durable and internally peaceful democracies, which are less likely to regress into civil wars. So finally, I'm going to end with a quote from one of my all-time favorites, Martin Luther King, who says, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder a liar, but you cannot murder a lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you cannot murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. It Returning violence for violence multiplies violence. Adding a deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness, he says, cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hatred cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. This is your opportunity to respond to the theme or the message today. Are there those who have thoughts they'd like to share?
Hi, I'm Zora. Well, in my studies of trying to figure out human nature, I've just discerned two basic causes of violence, three in a way, but they're linked. So, of course, there's the imitative factor, which is if you're violently treated and you don't resolve the issue, you will continue to do it yourself to others. But what's a deeper layer of that is real self-hatred, deep insecurity, and pain, and fear. And it gets projected outward onto other beings. The third thing, which I experience in myself and I see also in others and students I'm teaching, is if someone is a very passionate person, has a lot of emotion, and is seeking to control and dominate that passion as it's being expressed, that deep feeling, it can become violent. But the alternative is finding safe vents and safe ways of expressing that. The arts are one way that it's done. You just yelling and screaming, pounding things, not people, of course. But anyway, so if you say I have this rising of energy in me, this arising of insecurity or a belief that I should dominate others, realizing that you can master it, that you can find ways to guide it and to channel it, because it's energy and that's attempting to block itself. So that's just some of my thoughts.
Thanks for sharing. Are there others? Elsie?
Thank you, Mark. This is a topic we benefit from. You've talked on it once before, and I have read the book you recommended. I can't remember the title, Jesus in the Third Way.
Walter Wayne's Jesus in the Third Way. Great ideas. Theology is...
Yeah.
But it's not horrible. But his thoughts on nonviolence are
non-violence.
Really astute. Yeah.
And one thing that is interesting to me, you've heard me talk about it before, the book called The World Before Yesterday, or The World Until Yesterday, where pre-industrial societies were studied. And it appears that pre-industrial societies, a higher percentage of the population died through... died from violence in the inner group conflicts that frequently were a part of our how we lived as people living off the land, and that we now relegate a lot of the violence to specialized people actually a lower percentage, even though the violence is horrific in the world today.
Yeah, absolutely. If anyone's interested in that book, Jesus' Third Way, by Walter Wink, who I mentioned, I have a few extra copies. It is one of my favorite all-time books, but even while I don't agree with all the theology, I have a couple of extra copies in the office if anyone wants to borrow one.
Hmm. I think this might relate, but there used to be a group locally and also statewide, People of Faith Against the Death Penalty, and Frank Dew was very involved in that. He used to meet here, and I was involved because I didn't think we had the right to decide when someone else should die. Now, I think it was effective in some ways because I haven't heard or read where we carried through on one, and more states were eliminating the death penalty. I'm almost afraid to talk about it. I might read about it tomorrow. But anyway, I think some progress has been made on that.
Absolutely, and I agree it is related, particularly how they approached it. Are there any others? Here we go, Rebecca down front.
Hello, I'm Rebecca. Brene Brown has a new book out, something about being in the wilderness, and I was flipping through it in a store yesterday, and there's a chapter about having strong backs, soft fronts, and wild hearts. And I just thought that that was a great way to put it because apparently, you know, and I just read a little bit while I was flipping through, but it's difficult to have a soft front unless you have a strong back and that you're, you know, standing up for yourself and things, and then that enables you to meet the world with a softer heart.
It's a great image. Are there any others? Are there more?
You may think I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I guess is that I believe that all there is God, and all there is love, and there's love in God in everybody, and our oppressors as well, and everything is either an expression of love or a call for love, And I think that when we use words like nonviolent, you know, it just brings up the us versus them kind of philosophy. But if it's, we could use like maybe compassionate interaction, maybe that changes the vibration and sees that it's a way of being with them in a different way, and sure, changes our whole way of seeing us versus them kind of interaction.
And it's an interesting thought. For sure. Nope, we're good. Anyone else? Oh, one more. Here we go.
One more?
Yeah, this, let's let this be the... Where are we on time?
Okay.
Yeah, we'll wrap up after this with the feedback.
This discussion reminds me, there was a learned person asked how he was so successful, and he said it was just like mining gold. You have to go through a ton of dirt to get 1 ounce of gold. And he says, when you're looking for, you're wanting gold, you look for gold, you don't look for dirt.
Appreciate that very much. Rachel, we turn it back over to you.